One of the things I've been taking a look at while the country once again examines its long history of racism is the propensity that many white people I know, myself included, have to feel like they are free from any racist or prejudiced habits or ideas. This mindset is troubling because it can stop us from doing necessary, difficult work when it comes to confronting and attempting to offload our own biases. It also can lead to harmful actions where we might say or do something that is ignorant or biased, even if it's unintentional. The logic behind this idea usually goes something like this. Well, I have many friends of all races and persuasions, so I know I'm not biased. Or on a larger scale, the country has majorly improved. We had a black president. Beyonce is the queen of the earth. We legalized gay marriage, and LGBTQIA folks are becoming more and more normalized in media and entertainment every day. Surely this means that the country doesn't still have a problem with prejudiced policies and institutions. It's an understandable conclusion that can be drawn by making a few simple deductive observations, but it's also the kind of reasoning that's landing so many people in hot water. The idea that you are free from racism or from any kind of bias, the thought that you don't see color or even consider a person's background when engaging with them, leaves you susceptible to making ignorant mistakes that could be very hurtful. I was talking to some friends the other night about this, and one of them put it so succinctly. She just said, "It's so weird, right? Racism, it's just so weird." And while that might sound like she was being glib or oversimplifying the issue, I totally got what she meant. Because when you sit down to examine it, it really is just that. It's very, very weird. It's weird that we have to have debates and discussions to try to convince people that the practice of othering certain groups based on characteristics that are just naturally part of their biological makeup is silly and outdated. As if there was ever a date in history when such an idea would have been appropriate. It's weird that we make determinations about each other based on the amount of melanin in our skin or based on the people we find attractive. And yet, we all know good and well that this is the truth of the world we live in. So, weird? Yeah, you bet your ass it's weird. But it's true, nonetheless. It's weird the sheer amount of videos that are surfacing recently of white women approaching people of color who are minding their own business and threatening to call the police for something that isn't a crime. It's bizarre how eerily similar all of these videos are, how we can pretty much predict word-for-word phrases that will arise from them when we simply see the thumbnail for the video. We can tell what the woman will sound like, we can bet she'll have a husband standing somewhere in the background awkwardly offering quiet support should things escalate and become physical. It's like these videos were all produced in some crappy viral found footage studio using a Mad Lib script where they just fill in the blanks based on the particulars of the specific event in the video. I can almost see it now. The woman says, "Excuse me, are you allowed to insert non-illegal thing here?" Then the person says, "Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Why?" "Because," the woman replies, "I actually work for," insert lie about where she works, "and I happen to know that what you're doing is illegal." "Okay, well, that's not true, so you can kindly fuck off and mind your own business." "Oh, it's like that? Well, first of all, you're not allowed to speak to me like that, and second of all, I'm going to call the police and tell them that I am being harassed and attacked by a..." Insert offensive description of the person being threatened by Karen here. You get the idea. But in thinking it over, in thinking about why these videos are so common, I mean, a good deal of garden variety racism is certainly the most obvious answer, but also I can't help but wonder if some of the people in these videos are falling victim to that same fallacy that I mentioned at the top. I wonder if they've managed to convince themselves at some point, due to the fact that they have a black friend, or they're friendly with an Asian coworker, or they have occasional pleasant neighborly banter with the Latino couple that lives next door, that there's no world in which they could be accused of being racist. Amy Cooper, the white woman who called the police because a black man was correctly trying to tell her that her dog needed to be on a leash, blatantly lied to the police when she told them that she was being threatened by an African-American man. This woman weaponized her knowledge that the police would most likely side with her and violently arrest, if not kill, Christian Cooper, the man she called the police on, no relation. She was clearly doing something incredibly racist and potentially life-threatening. And yet her public apology read, again, like a Mad Libs fill-in-the-blank cut-and-paste apology that we see all too often when these people get taken to task for their bad behavior. "I'm not racist," said Cooper. "I did not mean to harm that man in any way. It was unacceptable, and I sincerely and humbly apologize to everyone, especially to that man and his family." But there it is. "I'm not racist." Again, I want to be clear. What Amy Cooper did was racist, ignorant, and incredibly reckless. But I want to give her the benefit of the doubt for a second on this apology. This is a woman who lives in New York City, one of the most culturally diverse places in the entire world. She no doubt has neighbors, friends, and coworkers of all different backgrounds, ethnicities, sexual preferences, gender identities, etc. She peacefully shares tight living space with these people on a daily basis. It is entirely possible that she was just as shocked by her own racist outburst as Christian Cooper was. It well may be that by allowing herself to believe that she is indeed, quote, not racist, she may have allowed herself to become lulled into a state of complacency that left her open and vulnerable to slip up in a crucial moment. A moment where she felt scared, defensive, exposed, and called out. She panicked, and she reached for the nearest intellectual weapon she could find to get out of that situation. She didn't leave the house planning on having this interaction. She didn't know that Christian Cooper was going to approach her and ask her to leash her dog that day. She reacted instinctually, without taking time to carefully consider her words. And what came out was shockingly and undeniably revealing about what was lying just beneath the surface. The reason I'm thinking about this is because today I'm going to be talking to one of my closest black friends. A friend who I lived with for several years, who I've spent countless nights with, staying up late into the wee hours, debating movies, superheroes, video games, politics, and all manner of philosophical quandaries. A friend whose loyalty has never been in question for one moment since the beginning. And also, a friend who confided in me over dinner recently that he was having a hard time knowing how to talk to his white friends about what's going on in our country right now, because for years, he has consciously protected us from the darker parts of his experience as a black man growing up in a very predominantly white area. Just hearing this instantly triggered the thought that maybe I had said or done something in the past, however unintentionally, that had caused him discomfort or pain. And he had decided not to confront me about it in order to protect me from the difficult work of considering my own racial blind spots. Even that thought was met with internal defensiveness. No, I thought, if I had done something racist, I'd know it. I'm one of the good guys. And if he'd wanted to let me know about something I'd said or done, he knows good and well that he can talk to me. All these thoughts are what I'm currently contending with as I prepare to sit down with my old friend and ask him about his life, about our relationship, and about the truths he's been so diligently protecting me from for all these years. From a Blanketfoot recording studio in my one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today my very good friend Carlton Bluford is going to be sharing with me a bit of his perspective on what it was like to grow up black in Utah and on the pervasiveness of racism in America. This phase where, what do you think of this? It's ridiculous, right?
Yeah, it's kind of, it's like, I don't know why I imagine Mario Brothers, but like, I have this mic and then you have this like, mic.
It's insane.
Like, but it's cool.
Because it looks like this whole thing is the microphone. Like, I'm just talking to this giant,
yeah.
I'm talking into this giant microphone, but it's actually just a windscreen that I purchased that my friend sent to me that he found like, from some like Chinese company on eBay that makes these windscreens. And it's quite remarkable. It like essentially just creates a small room around the microphone. So there's a smaller instrument inside of this thing.
I see, yeah.
And it just like basically puts it in like a little styrofoam room.
Oh, wow.
So that anything that's outside of this screen that I'm talking into doesn't get in.
That's really cool.
It's perfect. Yeah. It just like fully deadens the sound and it instantly turns whatever shitty mic you have into like a way better mic. But it looks insane.
Yeah, it looks like a small house, yeah.
It looks like I'm talking into just like a cartoon giant like ba-bomb microphone.
That's exactly what it looks like.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that one just has a better, it's got a wider net anyway. I want to find a similar thing for that. I want to find like maybe like a shell that goes behind it and just sort of like cups it.
Sure.
And that would pretty much fix that. I thought I was going to use my unemployment money from COVID to buy like a $600 microphone that I had my eyes on.
Yeah.
And then I got this stuff that, and it just like changed the way that these sounded. And I was like, maybe I don't need to. Maybe I can just get gear that just
helps
makes them sound better.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
this is working. So
what just, you know, I have an idea because we talked about it the other night, but it was also the other night. But like, what are we talking about?
What are we talking about? yeah, I don't know. You said something the other night when we were hanging out that I thought, I mean, it kind of struck me because I was like, fuck, dude. Like, is that true? Like, is that what it's been for the last, you know, 14 years that we've been friends? But you said you were like, yeah, I don't really know how to talk to my white friends about like how I'm feeling or about what's going on because I've spent so much of my time being friends with them sort of like protecting them or shielding them from the darker parts of my life growing up. And I was like, whoa, like, do I not know about some of this stuff? And and then I also thought like, God, I probably have contributed in the past to feelings of like discomfort or like, and just like not known that I was maybe overstepping a boundary or, and it just, I don't know. It just like brought up a thought in me that I was like, and I obviously to your comfort level, whatever you feel comfortable with, but I sort of want to start out with just like talking about a little bit of your story and growing up and like your experience with racism as a black man.
Yeah.
It's something that I don't know if we've ever talked about.
Yeah.
So.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So this is right now?
Go ahead. Talk. Sure. I'm going to close this bathroom door because this thing drives me nuts. Our toilet like runs and you can hear it.
Okay.
Go ahead and start talking.
Sure. So, you know. This is interesting because I've actually never really talked about it, you know, outside of my own house or with my family. You know, but my mom was from Chicago, my dad was from California, and they met in Utah. And my mom already had my brother, but, you know, they grew up in a very different time and then came to Utah. So when I was a kid growing up in Utah, oh, man, I mean, you know, a lot of other kids don't, I know that other kids that aren't of color, they don't have to have the talk. We all had to have the talk. And the talk was,
I mean, like, how many black kids were in your neighborhood?
None. So yeah. There was us down the way where was another family that had a black kid. And he was adopted. And then there was another family who
was it like
was
a Mormon
half.
Family that adopted a kid? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's a pretty regular thing in Utah.
It's a very regular thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is interesting. That's another thing we can talk about. But we had to have the talk. And I'm not sure if they had the talk, to be honest. But the talk was, you know, one, you can't do anything bad around the cop. You can't do anything bad or the cops might be around. And if they're around, we don't know what'll happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you have to be incredibly educated. You have to work harder than everyone else. That you've always heard that. But another thing is that for me that really imprinted on me and my personality was that people size you up within the first 10 seconds. So when they meet you, you have to not only be nice and approachable, but you have to be you have to immediately let them recognize that you're not a threat.
Yeah.
You're not a threat. You're not going to hurt them in any way. And that you, you know, are, like I said, are educated and you're nice and you are a picture of what a good black person should be. And that stuck with me always.
How old are you when you start having the talk? Or, I mean, because it seems like this would probably be something that needs to, like, have phases of like, hey, look, you're going to be driving. You need to remember, like, if you get pulled over, like, yeah. How old are you when this?
Oh, so this is before I was in preschool.
Jesus.
When I was very, very young. And, you know, it's funny because, and it was right around that time. Well, it wasn't around that time, actually. That's not true. But there's a couple of stories that I'll hit here to share as examples. But my first experience with a white person ever, his name at the time was Aaron Burke. His name's Aaron Schweidler now. I still have to call him. I promise I will.
Aaron Burke.
Yeah. he didn't, I met him at my preschool, my first day at preschool. And he didn't say hello. He didn't ask me who I was. We were actually about to leave. And I remember being exhausted because the entire day I was being as nice as I could, as polite as I could.
And you're like 4 years old.
Yeah. And literally just, I remember being literally exhausted just from just trying to make everyone happy.
Make sure that everyone knows that,
yes.
That you're not a threat at 4 years old.
Yeah,
in
honestly.
In this preschool.
I mean, well, and you know, well, those teachers there were amazing actually. Most of my teachers were amazing.
Yeah.
But he comes up to me before I leave and he goes, hey, can I play with your hair? And I was like, wait, what? And he's like, can I play with your hair? And it was such a bizarre question to me.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, as a kid, you know, I didn't have that thing where I knew like, oh, you just think my hair is exotic and you want to run your fingers through my hair. No, you can't play with my hair. Like, I didn't have that yet.
Yeah.
It was just so surprised. And he talked to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, yeah, you can play with my hair. Can I play with your hair? And he was like, yeah. So we just started playing with each other's hair.
Mm.
And both of our parents walked in and saw each other playing with each other's hair.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they met
mm-hmm.
and kind of laughed and was like, well, this is kind of strange. But we literally became best friends after that.
Yeah. And it's like mostly innocent. It's like this thing of like, he just doesn't know anyone who looks like you.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know anyone who has hair like you and he never has. And it's like, well, what's that like? What does that feel like? You
right.
know? But also so fascinating that it's day one.
Yeah.
That it's like right off the bat, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're 4 years old. You're already aware that you have to make sure everyone knows that you're nice and then make sure everyone knows that you're, you know, a good boy.
Yeah.
And then right off the bat. And again, yeah, like it's not like a hey, let me play with your hair. I've never seen anyone who looks like you before, but it is that right off the bat.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that's what's interesting to me now, speaking about it now, because mm-hmm. at 35, it brings back all of this. Like, I've never thought about how Aaron still to this day doesn't know how I felt about the other side of that.
Mm-hmm.
But even in North Ogden, I feel like North Ogden, Utah, where I grew up, was very, okay, so this is how I'll explain it. When I was started elementary school and we were learning about Black history, I remember my teacher coming to me and saying, "Now, Carlton, are you comfortable if we teach this to the class?" Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Not knowing how to react, because I'm like, I also feel like, well, you're the teacher. Like, shouldn't you be deciding what we learn? Like,
how old were you when you got asked that?
So that was like, what, third or fourth grade?
These are all things that I'm like, it might even sound innocuous, honestly, to like a white listener, like where I just think like, I'm familiar with the mindset of like, what's really the big deal about someone touching your hair? Or like, what, like, come on. Like, but it's like, it could sound innocuous, but it's also like, can you even imagine having a chat before preschool with your parents where they're like, now listen, kids are going to have some ideas that might come from their parents. And this is something that's so foreign to all of your friends that you grew up with. And to me, I can't imagine my third grade teacher coming up to me and being like, Austin, we're going to study the Greek gods. Is that okay with you? And I'm like, why are you asking me? Just like, yeah. Well, I don't know. I just wanted to check in and make sure that obviously I'm not Greek. I don't know why I made that analogy, but it just feels weird. You're like, I'm fucking 8 years old. Yeah. Like, are you comfortable with this? Like, we're talking about American history here.
Yeah.
Like, you know. Yeah.
But that's, you know, the funny thing about that, Austin, is that I've actually never been comfortable with it. And not to say that I would tell her, no, I don't want you to teach that. Of course I want you to teach that. But being comfortable in my skin didn't happen until well into college. Yeah. Well into college. I dreaded going to the swimming pool. I've never told anyone this. I dreaded going to the swimming pool because I was always different. And also as a kid, I looked like an alien. I had this big round head and like these long limbs and I had different color skin. And so I was just running around and I could see myself in my mind's eye and I felt like I looked ridiculous. And that was always the thing I had to get past before I could like really settle in and play with my friends. Plus, and I'm okay with saying this, I have a third nipple.
Oh, actually, yeah, I know. Yeah. I know that.
And so,
yeah.
That for a while was the thing I was like, oh, I don't want anyone to see my third nipple. But then after a while, I was like, nah, it doesn't matter. I was more comfortable with my third nipple than I was with my skin color.
See, now we're into the realm of relatability. Because yeah. I was also very large-headed, long-limbed, little boy with a little chicken bone in my sternum that people would point out and go, what the crap is wrong with your sternum? Mm. You know, and everyone would talk about how skinny I was and how big my head was. but at least I didn't have the added layer of I also look, just my skin is profoundly different from the rest of my friends.
Well, you know what happens, and I think you've talked to me about this before, but
yeah,
you know what happens with us, right? If we're not like, how I learned to protect myself was being nice to people and talking to people. And I think mm-hmm. how you probably did was to be funny.
Yeah.
Which you were, and smart, which you had in spades.
And just never stop talking.
And just, yeah.
just never stop talking. If I fuck up and I say the wrong thing, I'll just talk my way out of that. I'll just keep talking and talking and talking. But yeah, the coping mechanism. It's so interesting to hear you say this, to hear you talk about being taught from an early age to present eloquently and nicely, you know, to be nice and to present as a safe, you know, comfortable option for people. Because that's very much the way that I was introduced to you, was just like right off the bat, like, this is a nice guy. This is a kind person. And it's not that I expected anything different. Like I didn't... you know, be like, I wasn't like, oh man, what's the, like, you've always been a person who right off the bat, you're very warm, very, you know, so it's not like a bad lesson to learn, but it is so interesting to have that put in there as a safety precaution for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and you know, as we, So we're continuing with these stories because mm-hmm. I think they're important.
Yeah.
You know, as we began to get older.
We're moving through.
Yeah.
Are you comfortable with African-American history? Are you, yeah, and all this?
Well, yeah. And so my brother was going to, I can't remember exactly the school he's going to at the time, but he had a group of friends. Mm-hmm. And we were always very careful around our group of friends, our group of white friends. Mm-hmm. And for good reason. There was a girl, and he, I don't remember most of this, like the exact specifics, because I was much younger. But there is a girl that got mad at him because she asked him to a dance and he said no because he liked someone else. Mm-hmm. And so then she claimed that he raped her. And then as the authorities got involved and people got involved, it became clear that that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. And obviously she was young. She didn't realize how big of a deal that would be. Mm-hmm. But in our case, we got very lucky and nothing ever happened and he was fine. But of course, he didn't feel comfortable being in that group of friends in that school anymore. So he transferred schools. Mm-hmm. So that's why we went to different schools growing up.
Where did he wind up going?
He wound up going eventually to Bonneville mm-hmm. High School. And he bused every day. He took the bus every day.
That's quite a, it's that's very quite a far ways away from Weber High.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we lived in Pleasant View, Utah, and Bonneville is where it's closer to, well, it's in Ogden, closer to Layton. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a ways away.
It's a ways away.
So that, I mean, that's, and then for me, there was my first encounter or something like that was a little kid in a cowboy outfit for no reason. I had no idea who he was. He called me the N-word.
When was this?
Probably around fourth or fifth grade.
And he had to be wearing a fucking cowboy outfit.
It's so funny because I don't know. He was wearing a cowboy
it's
outfit
like
to school.
It's like the outfit brought it out of him. Like, he just was like, I don't know why I said that either. I put these clothes on and out it came. Like, that. Wow, that I don't mean to make light of it, but Jesus Christ, that's so...
It's just interesting, right?
Because again, it's stuff that being a person who's never called a person that word... I kind of go through my life thinking, like, people don't actually say that, though, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Like in the South, maybe they do, but, like, nobody in my neighborhood says that. Nobody, you know?
Yeah.
And then I talk to pretty much any of my black friends who grew up in Utah, and all of them are like, no, I was called it several times growing up, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, wow. Like, people – and whether it's a little kid who doesn't – who maybe doesn't even know what the hell he's saying – or it's something more nefarious.
Well, I think it was something he learned from his parents, obviously.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I think that he, you know, didn't even know me, but he was like, oh, that's one of those people. I'm angry at them. Mm-hmm. And so he calls me this, and I did what my parents told me to do. I told the teacher. And back then, it's so funny now I think about it. We had three recesses, three as kids, which is great. But
yeah,
like,
that was awesome.
Never happens again. It's like the biggest trick. It's like...
It's like morning, lunch, and afternoon recess.
Yeah. Like, never happens
and
in your life.
Class.
Yeah, and PE class. Yeah. But so I told the teacher, she kept him inside from the first recess. He was very angry about that. And the second recess comes and he comes out and he says, you're still an N-word. And I'm like, wow. So I tell the teacher again, because that's what I was told to do by my mother. And he was kept inside from recess again. Mm-hmm. So we have one more recess, third recess. I'm trying to avoid this kid, but he finds me, mm-hmm. you know, and calls me this again. And, you know, my mom, she's like, hey, like on her side, she's telling us you have to be very careful, follow the rules, don't stand out. Mm-hmm. You know, and my dad is like, yes, but sometimes you have to defend yourself, you know? Yeah. And so I felt like as a kid, well, this was the time for me to defend myself. And
thank God.
We were watching.
Did you kind of fuck him up a little bit?
Yes, I did.
Like this little fucker. Like I'm just thinking of this stupid little kid in his fucking cowboy outfit. Just like, hey man, I told the teacher twice, and now I'm gonna break your nose.
Well, none of us, it's funny because none of us, it's not like we know how to fight. It's
yeah,
not like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we had been watching not only Rocky, but Karate Kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Very religiously at our uh-huh. house. And so I felt like I've been watched enough Karate Kid. I can do this. And I did, actually. I never felt bad about it. I still don't feel bad about it. I'm sorry. But I beat the kid up.
Yeah, fuck that little
kid. We were
kid.
Brought into the principal's office later on once parents were told and stuff. I wasn't involved in that conversation. The parents were. But after that, the parents took him out of school and they left the neighborhood. Disappeared. And we were told that they literally moved and I never saw them again. So
that story is a really interesting microcosm for kind of how it works in society too. Like he got kept in from recess and he was really mad. So he got out and he, you know, like the feeling of like injustice. I remember, I just watched the movie Fruitvale Station. Have you ever seen that?
Yes.
Just brutal. I was like, kind of like hysterically, like sob crying for the last 20 minutes of it. And then, you know, the scroll comes at the end of the movie where it says what happened to the officer that shot Oscar Grant. And it says, you know, he was fired from his job and brought up on first degree murder charges, which and initially you go, oh, cool, great. And then it goes on to say the defense was able to argue that he was reaching for his taser and not his gun, didn't realize that he had grabbed his gun. And so they got it knocked down to second degree manslaughter and he served 3 months. And I was just, and then I read up about him and he felt like the 3 months was extreme. He felt like it was too much and he was like upset about and I just was like, first of all, he wasn't grabbing his taser. He was grabbing his gun.
There's
video evidence of him looking and pulling, unbuttoning the gun, pulling it out, cocking it, and taking the safety off and shooting.
Yeah.
Like we know, you know, it's like, no, you weren't grabbing your taser. And second of all, you think that getting off with 3 months for shooting a guy in the back was like not justice. So this little incident. And I'm not saying that this kid needs to be, I don't know, expelled or, I don't know, maybe that's what it is. Maybe straight up, like they just need to be like zero tolerance policy, sorry. Or like something more severe than kept in from recess.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like it needs to be like, we need to call your parents down here immediately. And like, I don't know, you know?
Well, and this is also this brings me to something I wanted to say too, Austin.
Yeah.
Because we're all angry. I think that a lot of us in this, and you know, when something happens to us, the first thing we want to do, mm-hmm. and you know, and obviously we were kids, but had I been able to even we sit in such different camps. There's a lot of people who are like, having a conversation, the time for conversations is past.
Yeah.
And as much as angry as I am, I can't believe that. You know, I feel like, for those people who on the first recess want to fight physical violence and use physical violence to solve a problem, I can't think that's the way. I think we do have to be very careful because violence begets violence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard thing to tell anyone. It's a hard thing to tell that mother, you know, hey, your child has been murdered and nothing has been done about it. Don't react in violence. I can't.
I think what it is it's hard to stand in judgment of someone who responds with rage, with justified rage.
Absolutely.
You can absolutely say, if at all possible, try to allow the system to do what it was built to do rightfully. And when it likely fails you, then maybe get pissed off, you know?
Well, and also, I agree, but at the same time, the system's screwed. So let's just change the system.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And those people who are arguing about, well, you know, it's like, no. Like, there's too many people who have died needlessly for you to be like, well, give the system more of a chance, I feel. Like,
we see that over and over again. The bereaved mother who tells, you know, mobs of protesters, hey, look, I want to let this thing go through trial and I want to see if we can get justice for my son or I want to, you know, like, and tries to tell people, hey, look, please, in respect of my family, let's try to protest peacefully. And then when the police officers are acquitted, it's like, All right, yeah, I'm pissed off.
Yeah, I mean,
and it's like, and what can you do at that point? Philando Castile's mom was like that in this podcast I just listened to about his death, where she kept her composure the entire trial, through everything, sat through, several days of court, watching this video over and over again of her son being murdered, and kept her composure. And then when they acquitted, when the jury came back and acquitted the officer, she stood up and just, fuck this, and walked out. And it was like, you know what? She sat there through the first recess and through the second recess and did it right. And
I just don't, it's hard, Austin, because being angry is not even the right words for it. Even me, who is, pacifist or whatever, or someone who wants to figure out what other ways than violence, I still have so much anger, man. And it's hard hearing other people argue the other point.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you don't know what you're arguing against. And you feel like you do, but you truly don't. You haven't sat... There's a song by the Five Stair Steps called Ooh Child. And every...
Ooh Child.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That, even now, mm-hmm. every single time I hear that song since I was a kid, it makes me want to cry. Because the whole song is saying things are going to get easier, things are going to get brighter someday. And we've been waiting for that my entire life. Waiting for that has shaped who I am as an individual in my DNA. So when you're talking about, they shouldn't be looting, it's like, I'm sorry, but you're lucky that we haven't murdered everyone, because we'd be completely justified to do that. But we're not. We're being so patient. We're being so, so patient because
so one of our phenomenally restrained.
One of our own kind even knew he was facing death and was like, do not fight them. Like, you don't understand. You just don't understand.
Yeah, when you try to get into semantics about statistics and stuff like that, and you go, well, actually, statistically, it looks like blah, blah, like whatever statistics you want to pull up to make yourself feel more comfortable and to excuse yourself from doing the hard work of looking at how you've been participating in this society that favors your group over another. Whatever it is, whatever argument you're looking to employ to get you out of having to just fucking support the movement, you're so right. It's like you just couldn't possibly know. You just couldn't possibly know what you're saying.
Yeah.
You just couldn't possibly have the first slightest clue what you're talking about. The best that I can do is like try to expose myself to as much footage and literature and just listening to people and just like people as I possibly can to get an idea of what it is, but I will still never, ever, ever be able to understand the psychology of being raised from day one with the idea of the talk. The talk for me was when I was, 13 years old and my parents found porn on the computer. Like, that's the talk.
Yeah.
That's, the talk wasn't, here's how we need to protect you from getting murdered.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. It's really, it's hard because, on the flip side, of me even saying all this, there's someone out there who's going, okay, so who's talking? He's this black guy from Utah. And if they're black, they may say, dude, he's a Uncle Tom. He, he grew up around white people. He's too white. He even doesn't know what he's talking about. There's that other side of it too, of not being black enough.
Well, let's talk about that, because you were raised around a lot of white people and in a very predominantly white area. What is your relationship with the black community been like? And like, in that, because I also know that too, that, and this is something we can talk about when we're talking about your story too, is like, how many times in your life has a white friend jokingly told you that you sound very white or that you present white?
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't say that. I mean, the thing that most people say, mm-hmm. And who are my friends, will say, like, you're the whitest black person.
Right.
And, yeah, that's shitty. But I always feel this need to bring up a but you don't know my friends. I mean, I'm not excusing that. But at the same time, it's like, these are friends who literally have saved my life.
Well, and look, man.
Like, literally.
Look, I don't know, but I might be one of the people who said, I don't know if I've said that to you.
I don't remember you of saying that, no.
But I wanted to at some point allow you to have the opportunity to let me know, and you don't have to do it on the show if you don't want to, if there's any time in the past that I've overstepped or used our friendship as a excuse to say something that maybe I shouldn't say, but being like, no, but we're cool. You know me, and I know that you're such a fiercely loyal guy and such a loyal friend, and that you have no interest in calling us a bunch of racist jerks, and that's just not you. And you also know that we love you, but also I think that because of the demographic breakdown and dynamic of our group, the group being 99% white and then like you and
yeah.
You know, it must have occurred frequently that people just made missteps and not mean-spirited missteps or
no. I had a conversation with Tracy Callahan earlier today and we were talking about this a little bit. I think now as I'm older, I might have done my friends a disservice because I did keep everyone. I always felt like the struggle and the things that have happened to me as an African American in Utah were on me. Mm-hmm. That was my thing to bear and to deal with and to talk to, mm-hmm. just to figure out. I feel like had I been more vocal about it, I think that everyone would just be more educated. I think that's the thing. And so I should have said, okay, yeah, I understand you were joking around, but that's not appropriate. And I would prefer that you not say that.
Right.
But at the same time, I know it's like, I'm learning now how to use my voice. I've never really known how to use my voice.
Right.
And you know me, and everyone knows me. I have a million thoughts a minute. I stutter over my words. Whenever I have a point that I'm really trying to make, I take a long time to make sure that I actually get it out. I've always let other people talk. I always have. So it is a new thing for me. It's a new thing for me to speak, really, to like really speak. And Tracy was saying she felt like I was allowed to do some of that specifically under construction in our piece that you choreographed.
Mm-hmm.
I was allowed to kind of speak. I was allowed to, when I sang Sam Cooke,
mm-hmm.
I was allowed to show some of that. I was allowed to use my voice in theater.
Yeah.
Which I have been, yeah.
Well, I think that you speak very loudly when you perform. I do think that there's always something that comes through that's like this. I remember asking you about it once. I was like, where does that come from? Like, because I was like, for all intents and purposes, like, yes, you've taken voice lessons and you've worked with people and you've gone through the same training programs that I've gone through and stuff like that. But like, there's this other level. I think we were playing Rock Band one day and you were like singing like some like Guns N' Roses song or something. And I was like, where does that extra register come from? And you were like, dude, it's just somewhere deep in the guts and you just gotta feel it. But it's like, that's, and I must say that the idea of you being psychologically, your mouth being shut and you having a hard time figuring out what's the best way to proceed forward with your thoughts and your voice and that all being linked to this is like blowing my mind, because that has been a staple of my relationship with you and knowing you, is that, yeah, like, it's kind of this thing that we bust your balls about, that like, you've got to stop and consider how you're going to say anytime you
yeah.
But putting it in this context of, it comes from this place of not knowing how to use my voice and how to appropriately use my voice and make sure I don't make people uncomfortable and make sure I don't accidentally say the wrong thing or alienate myself, is kind of stunning, man. It's kind of blowing my mind. It's kind of like something I can't believe I never considered. And
well, you have to understand, it's something I never really had to think about it until now. Sarah and I were talking earlier about the fact that most of my relationships have been them seeing a side of me that I chose to show them. There's an entirely other side. I know that in some really prevalent relationships of mine, they just never saw. And it didn't even occur to me that I wasn't showing them that side. It was just so inherent that I just do this. And Sarah, being from North Carolina, who she grew up around mostly Black people, so there's things that she just gets inherently.
Yeah.
And that's probably one of the reasons why we just slipped in so nicely, because I was like, oh, yeah, you got it. Mm-hmm. You know, you get this. But it's really, I've really done most of my relationships a disservice, because I don't really feel like that side of me came through at all. Like, since
yeah, but how much of that do you think is really your responsibility, man, and how much of it is ours? You know, like it's so you to take it on yourself and to be like, I should have spoken up, or I should have said this or that. But like, isn't it in the fucking 21st century, even if we're raised in ultra-white Utah, isn't it just incumbent on us to just try to do some basic cursory work to educate ourselves a little bit and know about what we should or should not be joking about? Or, you know, like is that really always meant to be your responsibility to educate us?
No, but...
Yeah.
No, but it's like... You know, it's until something changes, it is.
Like I said, it's. I think that you are taking on too much. Like being like thinking like, oh, I let people down. I should have let them know. And you know what? It's like, there are those people who are very vocal and very outspoken, and God bless them. And like, yeah. And thank God we have them. Thank God we have the people who have learned to be, you know, ferocious lions who aren't afraid of losing a friend.
Yeah.
Because it's not a real friend anyway, if they're not going to be able to hear you when you're trying to speak truth. But I don't know, you know, I guess my view of it is, anything that I did in the sense of being insensitive or ignorant or not knowing is always going to be just squarely on me. You know, it's really no one else's responsibility to make sure that I'm acting right, you know?
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
I just also, you know, we are a nation divided.
Mm-hmm.
And even within the African-American community, we're divided sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a while ago, I had a castmate in a Plan B show who was... Republican, and we started talking about some politics, and he invited me to this Republican Facebook group, and I was like, yeah, of course, I'll join. And I did that because a lot of the things we were saying we agreed upon,
mm-hmm.
and some of the things we were saying we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to, I don't know, get more eye to eye with what he was talking about and what they were talking about.
You want to understand.
I want to understand where
the opposition argument, rather than just assuming that it's
And when I did that, and there was a specific thing we were talking about at the time, and I was reading all these things, and I was able to voice my opinion and say, "Hey, listen, I'm more Democratic, but you know, I was able to talk with a group of people." Now, granted, there are always those who are very, very far left or very, very far right. And mm-hmm. they just believe what they believe regardless of any conversation. And I don't know how to fix that. But there were a group of people who were like, you know what? I didn't think about this way before. And I'm glad we had someone who was Democratic in the group talk about that. Mm-hmm. I felt very cool. I mean, we didn't even actually come 100% to agree on the topic. But the fact that we were having a conversation, you know, is what I imagine this country is.
Yeah, and the fact that there was any kind of common ground being seen or any kind of enlightenment occurring where someone's going, oh, I hadn't thought of that. I know exactly what you're talking about. And anytime I've been fortunate enough to be in a discussion like that, where I'm talking to someone who I really disagree with about something, right. but rather than letting emotion drive the conversation, we take time to really respond to what the other person's saying as we see it.
Right.
Like, I hear you saying this. Is that correct? You know, versus like, you're saying this, you fucking idiot. It's like, okay, what I'm reading is that you just said this. Is that, am I reading that correctly? I think the problem with that might be this, if you considered this, you know?
Yeah.
And when you can have a productive conversation like that, and just like you said, not fully changing someone's mind or fully converting them, but just having a conversation where there's responses from both sides of, oh, I didn't know that actually. Thank you.
Right.
I hadn't actually considered that. It is really inspiring. But also, like, you also see how difficult that work is.
It's insanely difficult.
And how much time it takes.
And if it's not patience, if it's not done delicately, people become entrenched.
Right.
Regardless of what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, I mean, you know, I've talked to people about this before and they're like, why would you spend that much time to do blah, blah, blah? I'm like, because the alternative is we kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
The alternative is that you take the group of people who don't agree with you out to the sea and sink them and watch them die and then live happily ever after. Is that what you want?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not the answer either. So
yeah, so often you kind of hear people talking about that hyperbolically, but also not so hyperbolically, where they're just kind of like, we just need to wait for them all to die off. It's like, well, they're not gonna.
People
will just literally be like, I don't know, there's nothing to be done about them, we just need them all to die off. It's like, yeah, but they won't.
Yeah,
though.
They won't.
So they're always gonna be here, we're always gonna be here, and we've got to continue to try one little step at a time.
We gotta find some common ground.
Yeah,
we have to.
Yeah. And I've always respected that about your approach to these things. And I think that also is kind of what guides your always being very thoughtful and careful with your words too. I think that's also wrapped up in that.
Yeah.
I'm curious, when you talk about dating people and only showing them a certain side of yourself, or only showing a certain side of yourself to friends, or a certain side of yourself to, you know, other people in the African-American community, or like what, in your mind, have you considered, like, what is the side of you that most often gets hidden or not put at the forefront?
So a good example of this, and you know, hip-hop is the first thing that comes to mind, but a good example of this is we did a thing called Broadway Theater Project back in the day. And actually, a friend of Lin-Manuel's wanted to do a song called Tradizzle.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know Tradizzle?
Uh-huh, I've seen the video, yeah.
Yeah, so uh-huh. Like, it's like this hip-hop version of Tradition from Fiddler on the Roof.
It's like, a fiddler on the roof sounds crazy. No, he must be drinking 80 proof. The way he
plays his notes and the way he goes. Silhouetted by the moon. He's just like you and me trying to scratch out a simple yeah.
We are such nerds.
No, but that's so funny. That's awesome.
I literally, I can't believe I remember that.
No, it's so good. And so I remember just wanting that part so bad. And and I don't even know if you know this, but I grew up because my brother has been writing hip hop beats and music for over 20 years. And
mm-hmm.
and I used to write hip hop when I was a kid. I used to write hip hop. I used to write hip hop.
You had bars.
So I had bars, bro.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so I knew I could go in there and just spit and hopefully it'd be good enough. I've never really like done it for anything like this, like an audition, but I was like, hopefully it'd be good enough. And I was like, I mean, there were other black kids there. There was in Florida, which was great. But I was the only black kid who went in there and spit some bars.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, great, you're the lead. And I was like, oh, great, you know? And so we did Tradizzle on stage for everybody for the first time, and everyone who went to school with the Weeper was like, bro, like, you rap. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I didn't tell you guys that.
So Mary and I went and watched Carlton perform in this singing competition called Off the Strip in West Hollywood last summer. And we would go like every Wednesday and watch Carlton sing at this club where the grand prize was 10 grand. And like, we would like vote for him every week. And Carlton's a beautiful singer. But my favorite thing that you did all summer long, well, I don't know, there were a lot of favorites, but I think, but like the one that I was like, dude, you were so fucking magnetic that night was when you did California by Tupac.
Yeah,
it was so good, dude. And you were so effortless about it. It was like that way, like that flow of like, he's been singing this song since he was 10 years old.
For
and
sure.
He knows every single word by heart. And like, and you were just so comfortable that you didn't have to think about a single thing.
Yeah.
And you were so in your element. It was really incredible. And it was like, you weren't singing like California. Like,
that's,
you know,
yeah, that's about
that's it.
That's it. Yeah.
But you fucking killed that night.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, but that's cool. Yeah.
It's just stuff like that. I mean, that's more like aesthetic, but I mean, you know, like these stories, like, you know, I mean, I've even dating, man, like I was always weirded out by asking anyone on a date when I was in high school because, or going home or picking up a date to go to a dance because I was black and what their dad would think and what their parents would think. And it's always been in the back of my head.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, I've had really great, you know, situations. Nothing crazy has happened to me, but I don't know. It's just stuff like that that I not hide, but I don't really speak about. And with the black community in Utah, it's almost as if we have this shorthand. We all just assume that we know something, or we've been through something, or we know. There's this knowing, and it's like so. I mean, there's a few of my really good friends. Most of my friends who are African-American in Utah know that I love singing rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
They know that, excuse me, they know that that I have an affinity for all kinds of different music and I'm not just stuck in one box. So it's like, that's not necessarily a surprise to them. Maybe surprise to other people, you know, if I sing Journey or if I sing like something else that I really love.
Yeah.
But I got a whole bunch of stuff in there. I'm more complex, I think, than I've given myself credit for. Which is interesting.
I've always seen flashes of that with you. Just that, like, there's so much there. There's so much, and you always surprise me. There's always stuff that comes out that I'm like, oh, I didn't know he could do that. But then I'm like, I guess yeah, that makes sense. Like, I guess you know, or like yeah, and is there? I wonder if with these sides that you don't really let come forward, is there a side that's more angry? Is there that? Because one of the things that I kind of really associate with you is that you've always had such a wonderful, even temperament. Now, I've been very good at pulling out some madness in you just because I'm such an infuriating person. I can be such an infuriating person to debate with. But I wonder if there's some of that, like, where you feel like you've consciously had to keep like frustration and anger hidden from people.
Yeah, I have a problem. I mean, not to joke about it, but I am very angry. Mm-hmm. You know, Jerry just hit me up and was like, because he was asking me about a play that I wrote called The Priesthood,
mm-hmm.
Just because the timing is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I told him I'm writing a new play, which I am. I stopped writing it actually before all of this happened.
Yeah.
I started writing it anyway. And I stopped because I was like, ooh, this play is too angry. It's too angry. I stopped writing it. And I told him I'm picking it back up again because I think it needs to be heard. But it's a play called Enemies and Allies.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise is about it's in the distant future where African Americans have literally killed as many white people in government as they can, and they're hunting down white people.
Okay.
And there's this black couple in this house hanging out with this white couple, kind of nonchalantly. But then there's a knock on the door, and it's this other black friend. And it's kind of like back in the days in Nazi Germany where they're like, you know, they're kind of looking in the house.
Yeah,
and
I'm kind of into this. This is like Tarantino, like just like those sequences of Django just fucking people up and you're like, I like it.
But, you know, yeah. Here's the thing. It's both, you know, obviously there's white people in the house and they're hiding white people, but these white people
are allies. You are harboring enemies of the state, are you not?
But they're allies.
Yeah.
They're allies who are fighting for the cause. And, you know, the angry black person's argument is that it doesn't matter. We don't want them to ever have a chance to do these things again. Mm-hmm. And in order to really ensure that, they got to be gone.
They had their shot multiple times. They had so many chances. We gave them first recess and second recess.
Yes.
And 30th recess. Yeah. And 50th recess and 100th recess. They ran out of shots. I think, God, I don't know, man. It sounds fucking cool. Obviously, that's not where I want things to go.
Of course.
But like, I do wonder about like, because I'm with you that I think that you get more friends with honey than with, or you catch more bees with honey than with vinegar.
Yeah.
And you're more likely to be able to sway a person if you can have that patient civil discourse that's difficult. And a peaceful protest is sometimes more powerful than, but also like at times like this, like I feel very much so like we need to create space to honor justified outrage and to honor justified anger.
Yeah.
Within reason.
Within reason, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole other part of that play is because we all feel that way. It's not like we don't feel like, I'm sorry, but I see things still every day. And I'm very good now at compartmentalizing all of this anger. Very good at it. Too mm-hmm. good. But I'm still very angry. But at the same time, we can't kill everyone.
Yeah.
That doesn't help anyone, even yourself. We know that. We've learned that. We have to grow. We have to learn and we have to grow. And this is what I want to say to everyone, not just people of color, but everyone out there. We're all angry. And we're angry for the right reasons and it's justified. But just because it's justified doesn't mean that gives us the right to take away people's lives / free agency. It doesn't. Mm. We have to figure out another way or else we won't have a world to come back to. That will be the end. I don't know the answer. I just know that I don't even know how to contain my own anger. So I just know that it has to be done. It's really difficult.
Yeah. Let's talk about one more thing.
Okay.
Cops. How do you feel about the cops?
Okay, so really great example. It was actually a story I wanted to say.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, there was a I don't know if it's going to be funny to you or not. You're not as childish as I am. But
try me.
But our DARE officer in elementary school, his name was Officer Siemens. Uh-huh. And
well, we're off to a good start.
He was the first cop I actually ever had came in really in close contact with, and he was the reason why I was like, yeah, no drugs. But also because he was so kind to me specifically, mm-hmm. I felt a kinship with cops. My grandpa was a cop. So that was my first starting with because I always thought, well, they're going to try to hurt me, going to try to kill me. But he was super cool. And I was like, oh, well, great. Like, maybe that's not true. However, when I was old enough to drive, you know, there's a by my house the speed limit is 30, mm-hmm. and there's a stop sign right by my house. Long story short, I'm driving home, pulling over into my driveway. So if you can imagine pulling over into your driveway, you're de-escalating. You're
right. You're slowing down to park the car.
Right. Twice, I've been pulled over
while parking,
mm-hmm. and given a speeding ticket.
Wow.
And when they said, do you know why I pulled it over? I was like, I have no idea. It's like, oh, you were speeding. And I was like, well, there's no way I was speeding. There's no way I was speeding.
Like, when did this happen? What? Did this happen like 6 blocks ago?
Yeah, No. And I saw you because I drove past you and saw you. And I saw you come around and I saw you pull me over. And
yeah.
There's no way I was speeding.
Right.
Twice I was pulled over. Twice I fought it. Twice I lost.
Yeah.
Had to pay a speeding ticket. Now, I didn't go to jail or get beaten up or anything like that. But there are little things like that that was like, it was almost as if like checking, do you live in this neighborhood? Yes, that's my house. I'm pulling into my house. It's like, okay, well, whatever. I mean.
Well, I'm, well.
Exactly. You know, so, you know, I mean, cops, I mean.
Do you think that reallocating the budget for the police force kind of across America into community organizations that could maybe answer calls about, hey, we've got a guy who's asleep in his car in our parking lot. Could you come pick him up? And rather than having police officers with guns show up, some team of trained people who do that regularly show up, knock on the window. Hey, man, can we give you a ride home? Give him a ride home. Do you think that's a good idea?
Yes, I do. 100%.
Yeah.
I do want to expound on that a little bit
mm-hmm.
because my grandpa was a cop.
Yeah.
And to say that cops don't face danger and that they don't lose their lives in the line of duty is ridiculous.
Yeah.
They need to be able to protect themselves and subsequently protect us. They mm-hmm. just, do they need millions of dollars to do that? No.
Billions.
Absolutely not.
Literally like a military defense budget. Like it's, yeah, it just, I think the just massive ramping up in the militarization of the police force, because that's, yeah, you're 100% right, Carlton, that people always go to, their job's really dangerous and really difficult and they need to be able to protect themselves. Yes, 100%, 100%. But we're talking about police forces with tanks.
There's no
and
need.
Police forces with, I mean, just like you see the gear, the, like just the ramping up of the weaponry and the,
right.
And also like so many of the videos that come out of police brutality, it's always like 12 on one.
Oh, 100%.
It's always like 12 dudes on one person. And it's like, I don't see where the danger is in this video.
No.
And people that, you know, the apologists will go, yeah, but they just don't know. They don't know if he's going to pull a knife out or
they don't know if he's going to,
that was the defense in the Rodney King case was they all said, we didn't know if he was, it felt like he was going to get back up. He was reaching for our guns. It's like, yeah, but there's like 12 of you.
It's insane.
And there's one of him and he's drunk. So like, you're telling me you can't, you guys should be able to handle that. No weapons.
Exactly.
No weapons. You know, like,
yeah.
And also no violence. You should be able to subdue
right.
the man. Just, you know, get the arms behind the back and subdue, you know,
right.
without kicking and punching. It's like, it's bonkers that we've been sold this idea that because the job is dangerous, and it is dangerous.
Yes.
You know, I did a TV show where I played a SWAT officer, and I was working that day with all the other officers on set were real police officers. And they were training me up on how to hold my gun and like what we do when we go into the building that we're raiding.
Yeah.
And I was asking them on like lunch breaks, like, do you guys do this often? Do you like break into homes and stuff? And they were like, yeah, all the time. That's what like our main job. And I was like, how often is there like a threat in there? They were like, enough. Like often enough, you break down the door and someone's waiting for you with a gun. And I'm like, yeah, that's a scary job, dude. Yeah. Like no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But also we're talking in those scenarios and we're breaking down the door of someone who we suspect is highly armed in there and dangerous.
Right.
Yeah, you got to be geared up. But in we're responding to a person who's kind of yelling at no one on the corner and someone called because they said they you know wanted somebody to check on him. Eight people show up and tackle the guy, put him in a chokehold. Like what the fuck's going on?
No, that's like, completely different. You have to not only be able to defend yourself in that job, but you have to be able to assess if a cartel is if you're fighting a cartel.
Right.
Or a human being who is asleep in their car or drunk right. or angry or even angry.
Even angry.
They're
even
mad at me.
Even a mad person.
Like
yeah.
you don't need to shoot that person. You don't need to be geared up to shoot and murder that person. And it's not okay. And what's more not okay is the covering up of that or the excuses of why. It doesn't matter.
The constant just defense. The constant like he didn't know. He didn't know what the guy was reaching for. He didn't, you know, like all this stuff. And it's just like, he shouldn't have been that ready to shoot in the first place. You see so many of these scenarios and it's like, the scenario doesn't call for hand on gun, get ready to fight. Like the scenario just doesn't call for that level of alarm in the first place.
No.
You know?
This whole the thing that makes me really mad is the percentage. Well, there are some bad cops out there, but 99% of them are good. Listen, My grandpa told my dad, first of all, my dad got pulled over many times when he lived in California and when he was growing up, but he got pulled over. He was mistaken for the Zodiac Killer. I don't know if you knew. I never told you that.
Zodiac Killer, the sketches of that dude are the whitest fucking things in the world.
He got pulled. Isn't that interesting?
That's
He got
crazy.
Pulled over and suspected for the Zodiac Killer. The only reason he got out of that situation was because my grandpa was a cop.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad tells me this even now, that his dad told him, listen, I'm a cop and there are good cops on this, but more than half of these cops do whatever they want. And stay away from, like, just be good.
Dude,
so you don't
that
to,
is wild.
That's, and that was then.
That's insider baseball right there.
So, I mean, who's coming up with these statistics, 99%? Like,
people who literally don't know what the fuck they're talking about. People who are literally talking out their ass are when they're constantly just going, there's millions of people on the police force in this country, and the vast majority of them are good people. It's like, how can you? That's such a crazy thing to say.
You and have also no idea.
We have so much evidence that there's at least several thousand really bad ones.
Yeah.
And like, even if that's the minority number, like,
that's enough.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
There's too many.
Yeah.
There's too many bad ones who are behaving badly, who are getting caught behaving badly on video, and who are remaining employed.
Yes.
After being caught behaving badly.
And not being arrested after they've done something horribly wrong.
After they've done something, committed a heinous crime. After they kill an innocent person in their home. After mistaking the address for like, and we just like, whoops.
No.
Whoopsie.
It's so, yeah, see, and I'm even with that specifically, I had to compartmentalize because that's enough for me. And I don't even physically know that person,
mm-hmm.
but that's enough for me to want to take to the streets and fight someone. That's enough.
It's
but there's so many more examples of things like that. There's literally pages and pages. It's gross.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
Yep. When people, we talked about this the other night at dinner and I made a post about it on Facebook right now, but it seems like right now the one name that is ubiquitously cool with everyone to talk about is George Floyd.
Right.
Everyone is like on board that Derek Chauvin, who killed George Floyd, committed murder and he should have been fired and should have been charged with murder. Everyone, regardless of where they sit, it seems like
that's the one.
That's the one that everyone's on board with. And I'm like, cool. Thanks for coming to the party, you guys. I'm glad that everyone agrees that this is clearly a misuse of violent force, and this is clearly murder that we're witnessing here. Glad everyone's on board. What's frustrating about that is it's just one. It is just one out of a staggeringly, just like you said, a disgusting amount of videos that you can look up just like it. And the fact that everyone's like, yeah, I watched that video, it's pretty horrible. I'm like, but do you know how many more there are? Go do a simple Google search. Just search police brutality in Google and watch the video and just watch a playlist for a day. Spend a couple hours just watching.
Do that and try not to get angry.
Just like you said, it is stomach churning.
Yeah.
I watched a video today when I made this post on Facebook of a guy having a dog sicked on him who's handcuffed. His hands are behind his back and he's in cuffs and he falls over and this dog attacks him and it takes them probably 6 minutes to get this dog off his leg. And his leg is soaked in blood by the end of it. And he's screaming in pain. And every time he turns to the officers to ask them to get the dog off, they point a taser in his face and say, don't look at me, turn your face away. It's horrifying. And it's just another video. Just add it to the list. It's just another video. And so when people are like, oh yeah, that George Floyd video is bad, I'm like, yeah, you're right. It was bad. But it is one of way, 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 way too many. And if that's the only thing you've ever seen, sorry if that disturbed you. Sorry if you had some bad dreams. Welcome to the party. That's not rare. That's not a rare thing. It's way too regular. And yeah, fuck. I don't know. You were much more nice about it than I am. So I understand that I need to compartmentalize that because, yeah, I get fucking pissed. I get sick to my stomach and I get really angry.
Yeah.
And then I have to come back to, okay, so what can be done? And it is these small conversations.
Right.
It's these, I think, in my sphere, if I can find the patience to have a conversation with someone I disagree with politically online, if I can find it within myself to have the patience to try to hear them out and listen, and then that's a thing. If I have the time and the availability to attend a protest, that's a thing. And if one of my friends of a person of color that I'm friends with is nice enough to come and talk to me and maybe inform me on some of the things that I maybe didn't know about them or ways in which I maybe have had blind spots in our relationship, that's another thing. But it's like none of that, even in its totality, is going to fix the thing. But it's just
– it's helpful.
Yeah.
And it's meaningful for me and it's meaningful for the world.
Yeah.
But I also think that in order for things to change, the people who run this country with all the money and the power – need to feel like it needs to change.
Yeah.
And until they actually feel like it's an important issue, it won't. Because what's going to happen is the protesting and the things that we're doing now in a very, very big way, I do think and believe are changing things. And I can't speak for every Black person out there, but a lot of us are sitting out here looking at white people.
Mm-hmm.
And going, wow, let's see if they'll listen to white people. I'm hopeful, but I'm so curious to see how this is going to play out. Because I hope, as angry as you are, imagine that for 400 years.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I don't even deserve the level of anger that I have, you know?
No, you do.
And, but also, yeah, exactly. On that other level, that's where I'm like, there needs to, because I agree with everything that you said, but I'm like, there needs to be a space to honor justified anger sometimes in your life.
Yeah.
Because while I also am like, yeah, I can't, the anger that I feel, exactly what you just said, imagine that being tied to every single day of your waking existence. But I think also that's why I need to be angry.
Yeah.
Because I've been allowed to live without it for so long and to be angry about more petty things and things like, how come no one's noticing my music? Or how come, you know, and obviously everyone lives their own circumstances and only has the lived experience that they have and can only really see life through their own eyes. But I think honoring a space for understandable and justified anger is something that I want to find a space for in all of this. Because I also want to say this, bringing it back to this idea of you being psychologically bound when it comes to speaking your mind and not being able to speak freely. And I don't know if I really don't know. I'm being an armchair psychologist right now and like psychiatrist. But this conversation right now that we just had, where you were describing to me some of your stories and some of your feelings around this stuff for what feels like the first time in our entire friendship, was incredibly clear from you. You were speaking with a clarity that I don't always hear from you.
Sure.
And so I just find that fascinating, that it seemed like the tongue was loosed and you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know what that's about. I'm not saying that it's me or my stupid show, but it's maybe this topic and having conversations like these where the point of the conversation is to speak freely and to be honest, even if it's uncomfortable.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
I will say, I don't know how much time we have left, but I will say my whole life, my whole life has been a goal to reach a certain point where I could bicker or be upset about the little things.
Mm-hmm.
I've always wanted to get to a point where I'd be mad that, you know, I didn't get an audition or my song didn't do so well or,
mm-hmm.
but have enough. And what's actually upsetting about right now is I'm having to, and it's my privilege to, I'm kind of, so Latoya and Candace in back in Utah are kind of heading up this BIPOC group about theater and minorities in theater.
Latoya's on the show next week. So
awesome. Yeah. She's a leader. Yeah. And I was talking to her sister Candace about this, and she's like, how can we get more of your time? How can we get you to help? Mm-hmm. And I was just like, you just asked me, so I'm there. I have to be a voice and I have to speak up. And I want to, but I'm really upset that I have to, because I was hoping that in my lifetime, I would be able to get past that and to be able to worry about the simple things. And that sucks that I am not going to be able to do that for a while. But at the same time, I will gladly join the fight. Gladly. It's just, it just sucks that we're still fighting is all. That sucks.
I think that's a pretty eloquent and elegant way to sum up kind of the conversation, at least for the episode. We can keep talking after I push stop, but the privilege to worry about the little things. Yeah, there's something I've taken for granted. I don't know, man. I'm just very glad we're friends, and I love you, and
love you too,
and I appreciate you coming and taking the time to open up about this stuff. And yeah, I don't know why we don't talk about this more. I think I don't ever want to bother my, you know, BIPOC friends by making them do the work of like educating me, like we talked about earlier. But I don't know. We got into it at dinner the other night, and I thought, hey, if you want, because that it was you saying that yeah. You were like, I've kind of protected people from this. I was like, well, shit, don't protect me. Let's let it rip. And I think you did brilliantly.
Thanks, man. And there are African Americans out there who are like, listen, I'm tired of educating. Uh-huh. And there are African Americans out there who are like my cousin, who are like, no, don't go talk to more white people. Like, talk to me. Let's get it done. And I feel I'm more of that camp. Mm-hmm. I am finding a voice. And if anytime you want to hear it, I'm here. Let's talk.
I really heard it tonight. I'm serious. I'm not just saying that because we're recording. It was pretty cool. All right, man.
Rock and roll.
Yep. So look, obviously this topic is way too expansive and complex for us to even begin scratching the surface in just a little over an hour-long conversation. But that's kind of the entire point. If racism is only racism to you, if it's a clear, outward, extroverted, seething, red-hot hatred that a person holds in their bones and in their blood for people of other races, if that's what racism is to you, is just the clear examples, KKK, white nationalism, you know, like these very clear, obvious examples, then you're missing a huge part, a huge just swath of what the actual experience of racism is for people of color in this country and across the world. It's more nuanced than that. Even with Carlton's story, we kept talking after we stopped. He stayed in my apartment for another couple hours, and there's just so much more to the story than even what he shared with me in the show. There's worse things that didn't get shared. So if you were listening to this thinking like, it doesn't sound like too many bad things happen. First of all, I mean, I think he shared enough, but also like there's more to it. And he's just one person. And that's kind of the just entire point is, I think the reason why Amy Cooper probably thinks that she's not racist, Amy Cooper, who, by the way, is being brought up on charges for lying to the police about Christian Cooper, that just happened. That was, I think the news came out about that today, as I'm recording this.
But I think the reason why she thinks that she wasn't racist is because, as far as she knows, she doesn't walk around with a very obvious, red-hot, seething hatred for people of different races. And I don't know, maybe that's not true. Maybe Amy Cooper actually is just, like, very secretly, like, really racist. But, you know, going back to the beginning of the show, giving her the benefit of the doubt, what if she just didn't realize that she'd been living with these sort of internalized biases and it just came out in this crucial life-defining moment? And I don't know, that's just me hypothesizing, but the point is there's more to it. There's more to be discovered, there's more to be learned about. The way that white people teach American history is very problematic and contributes to us not really fully understanding the full scope of this issue and its pervasiveness into modern culture. I think that we also live with this idea of, like, it was taken care of. The civil rights movement mostly took care of it. And yeah, there's some lingering things, but for the most part, we're doing a lot better. And that, I mean, we're not getting it, you know? And there's a lot more to go through than even, like I said, that we could cover on this show. But I kind of want the conversation to continue. And I as always, want to hear from you. So you can hit me up in the direct messages for the People Pleaser Instagram. Let me know what you think. You know, if I misspoke or made any mistakes on here, go ahead and call me out. I'm sure I did. Yeah, I don't know. It was nice talking with him. Hope you enjoyed that. Hope you maybe, I don't know, heard something that surprised you or who knows. You know, People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. The show is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. You can go to marmalademusicslc.com. Let them know that you listen to People Pleaser and take 20% off your first project. Marmalade is an audio engineering company that wants to take your single, your podcast, your album, your EP, whatever it is, they want to take it to the next level. So if you go to marmalademusicslc.com, let them know that you listen to this show and get 20% off your first project and get the ball rolling. Cool. You know, you can check out more of my stuff at austin-archer.com. I think that's about it for this week. We're running a little longer than I had hoped to, and now I'm just rambling, and it's over. The podcast is over now. Okay, goodbye. Love you. Bye bye. Stay safe.